That is my ambition, to have killed more people, more helpless people, than any man or woman who has ever lived. Jane Toppin, upon her arrest. Boston, Massachusetts, 1895. Given how aroused it made her feel to hold a dying victim in her embrace, it is hardly surprising that Jane Toppin enjoyed her work as a private nurse. No other profession could have afforded her such grim opportunities to satisfy her most monstrous urges. They were expected to keep virtually round-the-clock vigils at the patient's bedside, and the well-to-do often tried to cheat nurses out of their pay at every turn. The greed of her employers only served to make Jane Toppin's homicidal impulses grow stronger, and her methods more gruesome. Those under Jane Toppin's care seemed to have an unusual habit of dying. Her patients often suddenly took a turn for the worse, and never recovered. From near coma to convulsions, her patients would exhibit a wide range of symptoms that kept the clueless doctors guessing as to what the problem was. Patients were diagnosed with everything, from a bad heart to diabetes. In 1895, she lived in Boston with a kind elderly couple named Israel and Lovey Dunham. When Jane wasn't working as a live-in nurse, she boarded with them for several years at the Dunham home. One day, Jane decided that Israel was getting too old. So she poisoned the 77-year-old man because, as she later put it, he was getting feeble and fussy. His murder was falsely attributed by his physician to a heart attack. For the next 2 years, she continued boarding with Israel's grieving widow. Jane soon came up with an excuse to kill her as well. Mrs. Dunham, in Jane's estimation, you see, had become too old and cranky. When the elderly woman took ill that fall, Jane nursed her to death with her murderous concoction of morphine and atropine, dissolved in a bitter-tasting mineral water. Jane had always had a murderous contempt for the elderly that she had harbored, at least as far back as her nursing school days. Maybe she felt that they were useless and not worth keeping alive. Maybe it had something to do with her social status in life. Most of the wealthy in the Gilded Age tended to be the very old, personified by robber barons such as Vanderbilt, Carnegie, and Rockefeller. Or maybe she just liked having power over the frailty and functional decline that comes with the geriatric. Jane's resentment towards the elderly paled in comparison to that of the virulent feeling she secretly harbored towards a woman she believed had ruined her life, her foster sister, Elizabeth Brigham. So Jane Toppin, a sexual psychopath with a history of violence, decided to do something about it.
Spooky? Do you think I'm spooky?
I told my mom I thought I saw a werewolf. And my mom believed me.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay! is crap.
You think these people were eaten?
My dog stepped on a bee.
Unidentified flying objects. I think that fits the description pretty well.
Haunted human remains.
He's dead, but he has the power to move and kill.
She was bludgeoned to death with an axe.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
When I stand on the mountain and I say, do it, it gets done. If it don't get done, then I'll move on it. And that's the last thing in the world you want me to...
And this is the Spookies Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Spookies Podcast. I'm your host, Michael, the historian of the macabre.
And I'm your other host, Stephanie, the dark goddess of horror. And today is the conclusion of our look at Victorian-era serial killer Jolly Jane Toppin. This is Season 3, Episode 4, Jane Toppin, A Poisoned Mind.
So gather around the campfire because Stephanie is once again going to tell us a scary story. After she is done, I will be back on with Stephanie for us to play armchair psychologist, which is always fun, and speculate about what exactly went so wrong in Jane's troubled life that she became a monster. With my background in psychology, I will try to provide some psychoanalysis and answer whether Jane Toppin was born evil or a product of abuse, nature or nurture, or perhaps a bit of both. Okay, take it away, Stephanie.
With pleasure. Cape Cod, Massachusetts, August 1899. They say bad things happen in the month of August. Disasters and adverse events occur more often in August than in other months. It is considered a cursed month. August is when the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when Anne Frank was arrested, when the first income tax was collected, when Elvis Presley and Marilyn Monroe died. It is the month that Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 AD, burying Pompeii and Herculaneum in a cloud of fire and ash, killing thousands by boiling them alive. The apocalypse comes in a variety of forms: an asteroid colliding with the planet, the collapse of a marriage, or something as mundane as resentment between two sisters. The human experience ensures that the end of the world will always be deeply personal and emotional, despite the scale of what is unfolding. And the end of Elizabeth Brigham's world came in the form of a visit in August of 1899 to see her sister, Jane Toppin. August is a month of transition, and the unexpected often happens with the change of seasons. Jane had written her sister to come stay with her at a quaint seaside cottage in Cape Cod she had been renting for years. At her husband's urging, Elizabeth reluctantly wrote back to Jane, accepting her invitation. Elizabeth had been suffering from a mild but persistent case of melancholia. A few days at the beach, her husband told her, would do her good. Jane was Elizabeth's foster sister, and they had never really bonded. It wasn't that Elizabeth disliked Jane. She just knew her sister could never be one of them. They were from two different worlds. Elizabeth Brigham lived the life of a princess in Victorian high society. And Jane? She was the unwanted spawn of Irish infestation, a peasant and a paddy of little to no importance. Elizabeth pitied her sister and her inferior genes. Some people were born to work, and some people were born to rule. As Elizabeth's husband always said, that's just the way God made us. As a young girl, Jane had been adopted by the Toppins, who forced the child into indentured servitude. Jane had always felt more like Elizabeth's servant than her sister. When their wealthy mother died, Jane was left out of the will. Instead of sharing the inheritance with her sister, Elizabeth made Jane her maid. She became her sister's servant. Elizabeth believed she was doing Jane a favor. Elizabeth never thought much about how this might impact her sister's psyche. she never thought much about Jane at all. Jane eventually moved out and found steady work as a private nurse in Boston. It pleased Elizabeth and her husband that Jane seemed to have accepted her place in life. Whenever Jane would visit Elizabeth and her husband, the couple expected her to revert to her old role as an obedient servant, cooking for them and taking care of the household chores. Jane did so with a smile on her face. On Friday, August 25th, Elizabeth arrived in Cape Cod. The following day, she and Jane, wearing white summer dresses and striped sailor caps, carried a picnic basket to the beach. The women spent several hours soaking in the sunshine and salty air, chatting merrily, snacking on cold corned beef and taffy, and basking in the glories of the ocean, sky, and weather. Elizabeth had never enjoyed her sister's companionship more than she did that lovely afternoon in late August. That night, Jane gave her sister a glass of mineral water. They said goodnight to one another, and Elizabeth went to her room. Parched from her time in the sun, Elizabeth drank up as her sister had instructed. Before she could finish, the glass slipped from her hands and fell to the floor, where it shattered into 1,000 pieces. Elizabeth collapsed and vomited violently. She began to convulse as the door to her room creaked open. A figure entered the room carrying an oil lamp. It was her sister. Jane smirked. She had waited a long time for this. She stared coldly at Elizabeth with 30 years of spite and hate in her eyes. In the amber glow of the oil lamp, her face took on the shape of a skull. Her eyes were black and her teeth jagged like a shark. Elizabeth begged to know what Jane had done to her as she lay thrashing in a pool of her own vomit. Jane lifted her sister up off the floor and laid her down on the bed. She then slid a chair next to the bed and sat down beside Elizabeth. The nurse calmly sat down in the chair at her sister's bedside and watched as Elizabeth's symptoms grew worse, as her body was ravaged with violent seizures and painful spasms, drifting in and out of consciousness. Jane wanted to savor every moment of pain and torture her sister experienced. Jane didn't merely want to just kill Elizabeth. She wanted to see her foster sister suffer. The mineral water had been laced with strychnine, a deadly poison with some of the most dramatic and painful symptoms of any known toxic reaction. Strychnine decimates the central nervous system, causing convulsions strong enough to break bones and abnormal, sustained spasm of the facial muscles that appears to produce a hideous grinning. You die with a smile on your face. With forensic toxicology in its infancy, Jane had gotten away with poisoning murders for years because she knew more about pharmacology than most doctors and detectives. Jane told her sister that she had always hated her. She then told her stories of murder and madness, stories that made Elizabeth's blood run cold. Jane described the death of her victims as if she were a child opening presents on Christmas morning, of the fiendish machinations she employed in ending human lives, the exuberance and orgasmic pleasure which came to her when she saw the light go out in their eyes. Elizabeth heard every word, but couldn't respond as she continued to convulse from the poison spreading throughout her body. Elizabeth's eyes darted from her sister to things behind her that did not exist. Nightmarish, faceless things that howl and bite. Jane had mixed the strychnine with a powerful psychotropic hallucinogenic, which caused disturbing images of fear in its victims' minds, like a bad acid trip from hell. Even if Elizabeth had miraculously survived being poisoned, her mind would have been permanently lost to a drug-induced form of psychosis. The upper-class woman, now reduced to a desperate, tormented thing, barely clinging to life, she moved her mouth in spasms, wailing and emitting inhuman grunts as the seizures continued in starts and fits. This went on for hours. Then, as the end seemed near, Jane crawled into bed with her foster sister for one last embrace, the sweet embrace of death. She let her die slowly, with agonizing torture. Jane had killed dozens of people in her life, but Elizabeth's death was very special to her. Jane Toppin would later say that she held Elizabeth close in her arms and watched with delight as she gasped out her life. Elizabeth Brigham's fairy tale life had come to a grisly end. Jane would later say that Elizabeth was her only victim that she truly hated and killed with vindictive purpose. Now that Elizabeth was dead and buried, it was the perfect chance for Jane to seize her nemesis' life and claim it as her own. No sooner had Elizabeth been laid in the ground than Jane tried to seduce her deceased foster sister's husband. Jane possessed an utterly deranged idea that if she killed every other woman in his life, he would fall in love with her. She murdered both his housekeeper and his sister, killing both of them with her usual poisonous concoctions. Just to make sure all the attention was on Jane and Jane alone, Jane Toppin would later say she poisoned them because she knew the women wanted Brigham, including his own sister. Jane took over the housekeeper's duties and worked to impress Brigham with her cleaning abilities and organizational skills, with the delusional hope he would marry her. Brigham was uninterested. He made it clear that he didn't want Jane there as a servant or as a wife. He had always thought of her as a disgusting petty Irish vermin. Jane decided the best way to win his affection was to poison him and then slowly nurse him back to health. And when that didn't work, Jane threatened Brigham by saying she would accuse him of getting her pregnant if he didn't marry her. Outraged, he kicked her out of the house. In one last-ditch effort to win his affection, Jane tried to kill herself with morphine, or so she claims. She took just enough of the drug to make herself sick. Given her expertise in pharmacology, it is entirely possible her suicide attempt was more performative than sincere. At any rate, it didn't work. Oramel Brigham kicked Jane out of the house for good once she recovered and told her never to return. Oramel's rejection came as a devastating blow. Jane returned to Boston and back to her increasingly unfulfilling existence as a private nurse. When she got home, she threw herself on her bed and screamed into her pillow. She tried to commit suicide again, this time with morphine, and ended up in the hospital. Jane didn't kill again until Christmas. A wealthy 70-year-old widow named Mary McNair became sick with a cold on a holiday visit to Boston. McNair had traveled by carriage to see her ailing daughter. Her longtime physician, Dr. Walter Wesselhoft, sent his best nurse to care for Mary McNair. Jane slowly poisoned McNair, bringing her back from the brink and then poisoning her again just for sexual kicks. Shortly after the funeral, Mrs. McNair's family discovered that some of her most expensive clothing was missing. They suspected that Nurse Toppin had stolen them. When they brought their suspicions to Dr. Wesselhoft, he became deeply enraged. Jane Toppin, he declared, was one of the finest women and best nurses he knew. He would not listen to anything against her. Historians of the macabre have often wondered about Jane Toppin's habit of stealing. Was it really just petty theft, or were they trophies? Many serial killers collect them, including body parts such as human heads or bones. A trophy is in its essence a souvenir. It is a reminder of the power a murderer once held over their victims. Jane, it should be noted, did collect the eyeballs of a corpse from her secret experiments in the morgue. The arrival of January 1900 brought with it a new hope among the populace that America would find solace after surviving a century of horrors. For Jane Toppin, the arrival of January 1900 brought the arrival of something she had been longing for, the opportunity to lead a different kind of life. Jane learned an old friend of hers named Myra Connors had fallen ill. She had befriended Myra Connors, the matron of St. John's Theological School at Cambridge. So Jane rushed to her friend's side to help her, but not out of care or compassion. The friendship had a darker, ulterior motive. Myra had something Jane wanted, and Jane now saw her chance to take it. Jane, you see, wanted the life Myra had. Being a freelance nurse was a hard existence, and Jane had always wanted the life she felt entitled to, the good life. Myra's job came with a spacious apartment, a private maid, and a regular paycheck. For Jane, it was a life worth killing for. So Jane murdered her old friend, Myra Connors, in order to take over her position as dining matron at the theological school. At Myra's funeral, Jane approached the dean of the theological school and informed him that Myra was planning on going on sabbatical, and she had intended to recommend Jane for the job. Jane lied to the dean and told him that Myra had instructed her on all the duties of the position. Without any other viable candidates, the dean offered Jane the post, and Jane accepted it out of supposed loyalty to her good friend. Her scheme had paid off. It was all proceeding as planned. No one suspected the truth, that Jane had poisoned her old friend with strychnine, the murder providing her with almost as much unholy pleasure as the night she killed her sister 6 months earlier. With her usual brand of cunning, Jane Toppin had murdered her way into getting her dream job and stealing someone else's life. It could be seen as a Pyrrhic victory. While Jane did indeed get the job, it didn't last. Questions about her competence arose almost immediately. Accusations of theft, combined with her lack of experience in management, meant that she was asked to resign after a year. It was yet another cataclysmic blow to Jane's superiority complex, and only served to reinforce her deep-seated rage against the world. Jane consoled herself by returning to the scene of her greatest triumph, the holiday cottage in Cape Cod, where she brutally tortured and murdered her sister. Jane needed to recapture the emotional high of the murder, relive the thrill she felt between her legs, watching the light drain from her sister's eyes. In the summer of 1901, Toppin finally went too far. Jane had rented the same cottage for years in Buzzards Bay, from a man named Alden Davis, who got rich building a railroad linking Boston to Cape Cod, the same cottage where she had sadistically murdered her sister with poisonous delight. Alden and his wife Maddie adored Jane, as did the entire town by most accounts. The affluent Davis family had been renting it out to Nurse Toppin since 1896. Since they were fond of Jane, they'd given her a good rate. And after the sudden death of Jane's foster sister in 1899, they didn't ask her for rent for the entire year. The next year, in 1900, Jane asked for an extension as she didn't have enough funds on hand to pay for the rent. But when she returned to the cottage again, and didn't bother paying then either, Maddie Davis decided to go to Boston and confront her in person. Maddie knocked on Jane's door and told her she owed the family $500, roughly $15,000 modern day, adjusted for inflation. Jane smiled and welcomed her inside. It was unusually hot outside, and Jane offered Maddie something to drink, a tall, refreshing glass of mineral water. Jane offered to walk to the bank with Maddie to withdraw the money to pay her debt. Maddie nodded, and as she stood, she felt dizzy. She didn't feel well, she told Jane. Jane sent for Maddie's daughter and helped the old woman to her bed. The doctors were baffled. Jane spent a week poisoning the old woman, thrilled at all the chaos and suffering she had created. This went on for an entire week, and then Jane injected Maddie Davis with a massive dose of morphine. Jane Toppin was just getting started. At the funeral, Maddie's two daughters, Genevieve and Minnie, grieving over the loss of their mother, asked Jane for help taking care of their heartbroken father. They made the fatal mistake of asking Jane to stay on as their house guest in Cape Cod for a while. Jane Toppin amused herself by starting fires around the house, and then inventing a story about a mysterious stranger she'd seen skulking about to blame for them. Eventually, though, her homicidal urges returned. Jane Toppin craved bedlam, mayhem, thrills, always teetering on the razor's edge, because stability threatened her warped psyche. Her life began in chaos, and Jane had become an agent of chaos herself. And this time, the darkness in her black soul would ultimately lead her to her own undoing. One by one, Jane went about systematically annihilating an entire family within the span of a few weeks. One by one, they would all die by her hand. Genevieve Gordon, Maddie's daughter, was clearly suffering in her grief. Jane decided this was an opportunity to gaslight the family, and told Minnie, the other daughter, that she had seen Genevieve inspecting a canister of arsenic in the shed. The two women decided to watch Genevieve carefully in case she did something rash. Then Jane, with ever-increasing recklessness, murdered Genevieve with arsenic, a truly horrible way to die. Jane's methods of killing became more sadistic and risky as her mental state spiraled out of control. She could not rest. What is a psychopath but a volatile abomination not in control of themselves? Throughout her career as a bloodthirsty serial killer, Jane Toppin had steered clear of the metallic poisons, too easily detected. This time, though, she had plausible deniability to let her experience a new type of death. Genevieve's official cause of death was recorded as heart disease. 2 weeks later, Alden passed away from grief, given a helping hand by Jane Toppin's poisonous concoctions. Jane murdered Minnie only 4 days later. She filled a syringe with the morphine cocktail which she had normally mixed into mineral water. Then, she injected Minnie with her deadly alchemy. What Jane did next can only be characterized as abhorrent even by her standards. For reasons unknown, Jane went upstairs and retrieved Minnie's 10-year-old son, Jesse, from his bed. She then carried the half-awake child into his mother's room. Holding Jesse in her lap, Jane forced the child to watch as his mother's body violently convulsed from the poison in her bloodstream. The doctors were unable to determine what Minnie died of, and chalked up her unexplained death to exhaustion. Jane would later say, with her trademark smirk, that she made that summer in Cape Cod lively for the undertakers and the gravediggers. Unfortunately for Jane, the death of two generations of a powerful and respected family does not go unnoticed. Minnie's father-in-law, you see, was a man by the name of Paul Gibbs, a police captain, who grew suspicious of Jane Toppin. Gibbs pulled some strings and had the body of his daughter-in-law exhumed in an attempt to look for evidence of foul play. He got what he was looking for. An autopsy conducted on Minnie Gibbs' corpse found her body riddled with poison. Sweet, caring Jane Toppin was arrested on charges of murder to a stunned and disbelieving world. The total number of lives ended at the hand of Jane Toppin remains a mystery to this day. She later confessed to 31 murders, although many believe the number is closer to 100. The truth is, no one ever believed it could happen. The notion that a woman could be a murderer went against Victorian sensibilities. Women were seen as mothers, housewives, damsels in distress, incapable of committing grisly acts of violence and cruelty. eerily similar to how Twitter sees women today. Jane Toppin was declared morally insane by the court, and on June 23, 1902, she was sentenced to be committed for life to the Taunton State Asylum for the criminally insane. Jane had always been terrified of being locked up in the madhouse. She had been vocal about how she preferred prison to being institutionalized. Jane Toppin's greatest fear had become a reality. She would spend the rest of her life confined to a deeply unpleasant place with a history of abuse, torture, and experiments on the patients. And Taunton was considered by many as one of the more compassionate psychiatric facilities of its day. Now, Jane was at the mercy of other nurses and doctors who thought of her as a lab rat. In an ironic twist of fate, Jane became paranoid that the nurses were poisoning her food and drinks, so eventually, she simply stopped eating altogether. Jane Toppin became gaunt and frail. Terrified of being poisoned, she even wrote letters to state and local authorities complaining of her treatment in the lunatic asylum. Jane grew increasingly violent following the onset of her paranoid delusions and kept in a straitjacket for many years. Whether Jane Toppin was criminally insane is still up for debate. What is known is that after less than 2 years confined to the asylum, Jane's mental state deteriorated so badly that a doctor wrote, and I quote, "She now has a mind only found in the imbecile." It is unclear what role the doctors played in the unsettling changes to Jane Toppin's mental capacity. The violent and paranoid woman became a docile, half-crazed old lady. Just another patient in the madhouse who caused no trouble. One who had trouble remembering her own name. First, she was Honora Kelly. Then, she was Jane Toppin. In the end, she was no one.
I gotta say, I love that ending. Like a classic episode of Tales from the Crypt. I don't know whether I should cheer or cry. So, let's play armchair psychologist and speculate on what went so horribly wrong with the tragedy of Honora Kelly / Jane Toppin. So Jane claims that she became a serial killer because her boyfriend dumped her when she was 16. She even made a TikTok about it, Stephanie.
She did.
If I had been a married woman, I probably would have not have killed all those people, Jane once said. I would have had my husband, my children, and my home to take up my mind. I would be too preoccupied to go poisoning people. Do you buy that, Stephanie?
No.
Why not? What's wrong with that explanation?
She probably would have developed some kind of abnormality anyway. It was already happening to her because of the conditions in her home place growing up. So I think maybe in her mind, she thinks maybe that would have fixed her or cured her because those were the things that she most wanted. And in Victorian society, to be unmarried was like being an old maid. It really didn't look
good.
They
call it old maid, and it's also spinster.
Spinster.
Spinsterhood.
It's sad because, you know, women were forced into this. You know, it's not even that different today. There's still pressures to be married. Now, you don't suffer the same.
The marriage industrial complex.
The marriage, the having the children. If you don't do these things as women, you're not a real woman. So single women who are, like, professionals are still looked down upon by other women and society at large. Not to the same extent in the Victorian era, because women have more rights now. But It's strange how things don't really change.
Well, there was a study done, and they found out that people who don't have children are still annoyed by couples who don't have children. That makes no sense.
That makes no sense.
But it shows how deep the socialization and indoctrination goes.
Do you think it's just that, or also that we have a need to procreate? That's kind of ingrained
in our biological.
It's biological.
Maybe. Yes. But I think Jane killed because she liked it.
Yeah.
I think it made her feel powerful and in control.
Yes, agreed.
Her story begins and ends with control.
Yeah.
She ended up under the control of others because she couldn't keep her deep-seated rage in check. This has always been about control.
Yeah.
And with a sexual psychopath / sadist, it's always about control.
Right.
She's often described as an angel of mercy. I don't understand why.
There's no mercy here. All of these poisonings are hideous. They're horrible.
Well, angel of mercy is a type of serial killer who deems themselves providing a service to those to put them out of their misery. And that doesn't seem applicable to Jane. She didn't murder for the good of her patients, but out of pleasure, out of a perverse satisfaction. With patients, it was sort of a sick experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
With the Davis family, it was a means to an end. With her foster sister, Elizabeth, it was revenge and reckoning with childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, she killed because she enjoyed it and she gained from it.
Right.
There was no mercy to these murders.
I would even say with the sister, it's probably, it's combined with rage at the foster mother as well.
Yeah.
Because the sister is like, you know, she's directly related to that woman. So they're, in a way, it's like they're the same person, maybe in her mind.
Why do you think Jane became a murderer? Because as far as we know, she doesn't become a murderer till she's almost 30. And that's really weird and unusual.
We don't know if she wasn't already poisoning people or experimenting with...
She never mentioned that, and she bragged about her killings.
Right, but she could have been doing light seasonings of poisonings. Not
well, she
death.
Had a history of pathological lying.
Yes, so the makings are already
and
there.
And petty theft, which are all symptoms of conduct disorder.
I mean, you go back to, again, society at large has failed her. They failed many children in that era. This is a time period when industrialization is really ramping up, and people just thought it was normal to put little children into these factories and have them work to death. And poor families, in particular immigrant families, especially when they're locked up in these big cities, because they're forced out of their homelands out of necessity. I mean, this is not that different than what's happening from people coming up from South America,
right,
to the United States. You don't just leave your home because you want to. It's usually because there's some kind of calamity happening. So at this point, it would have been the potato famine that could have been prevented by the British government, but I digress. So anyway, you have families who are burdened with the expense of living in these big urban cities. They're grouped into these very small homes. Everybody has to work, and I do mean everybody. As soon as you can walk, they're
putting
children...
Well, there were no labor laws.
There's no
then.
Labor laws, and there's no safety net, and there's no unions to make sure that people are being paid fairly, that they're being treated well, that they're not being overworked. And so you've got things like alcoholism going out of control because of the close conditions. Diseases that could be prevented just by spreading people out a little more are going crazy. You have issues with water sanitation. So there's a lot of pressures on families in general to provide for their wife and children, and everybody has to work. Now, with Jane, her mother died, and the father, he was not able to care for, what, four daughters, I believe, in total?
I believe it's three.
It's three?
Yeah.
So he drops them off at what, and I'm assuming these supposed charitable organizations are saying, well, take care of your children. If you can't, poor, disgusting Irish...
Patties.
And... people did do this. They did drop their kids off in orphanages, not necessarily because they didn't like them or because they didn't love them or they didn't want them. Literally, they just had nothing to give them. It was either that or starve.
Well, he was also abusive.
But her father was abusive, so it starts there.
But
then she's put into this home and then given to a family to become a slave.
I was going to say, there are plenty of people right now
mm-hmm.
walking around who are sociopaths.
Yeah.
But they have never killed anyone.
Right.
They don't commit violence. They don't commit any violence against others.
But we don't know what would happen if you put that kind of personality with the right pressures against it, especially in a formative brain.
There's also something else, though, which is that Jane is not a sociopath. Jane is a psychopath. And in my professional opinion, out of her goddamn mind.
Yeah.
But what do you think is the big turning point in her life? Is it when her foster mother dies and she doesn't get that inheritance and she's forced to be a maid? Because I think that's it.
That's probably the linchpin right there. But I think it's been happening for a long time. Her identity is stripped from her. She's made to be a slave for all intents and purposes, yet her name is stripped, so she's technically a Toppin, but she's not really a Toppin. So it's like being a Cinderella, but always staying the Cinderella. There is no prince.
Yeah, it's
a
macabre twist on Cinderella.
There's no saving her from this. She has a history of mental, or her family has a history of mental illness. So you've got pressures already there. And then you add in an abnormal amount of stress. We don't know what that other woman did to her, but I'm assuming that she abused her pretty heavily.
Yeah. Psychology teaches us that shame and humiliation are common factors in the genesis of malevolent personality.
Yeah, it would create rage. It would create resentment.
But she has a genetic predisposition for insanity.
Yes.
Both her father and her sisters were mentally ill. Mm-hmm. At least one of them was.
Yeah.
Her father clearly was. We don't know about the mother. She could have been as well.
Yeah.
She is the victim of abandonment, abuse, and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
An abandoned child given to a wealthy family for the sole purpose of being a slave.
Yeah.
Like Anakin Skywalker. she won the lottery, but someone else got to claim the prize.
Yeah.
That's the way you have to look at this.
She's told, oh, here's your sister, but that's not really your sister. You know, you're an outsider.
She's made to be her sister's servant.
Exactly.
And can you imagine how demeaning and dehumanizing that must have been? Even for a person who was normal, that would kind of fuck them up.
Oh, it would most assuredly make you not right and not okay as an adult.
It never seems, as much as I've researched this case, it never seems that anyone loved her.
Yeah.
Never. She was alone in the world, alone with her dark thoughts, ruminating on her dark thoughts. And as what we know from studies, women ruminate. This is not sexism.
I ruminate far too much.
And when you have no filter or no outlet for those thoughts, they're gonna metastasize.
And also, I mean, again, back to this lack of love, and you have a woman who's a mother figure to her, who does not treat her as a daughter, who does not treat her as a child, or anyone deserving of love or care or affection. How is a developing child's brain supposed to cope with that, supposed to then develop empathy of their own if they're not shown any?
Well, she carried all that rage with her for years.
Mm-hmm.
Bottle rage.
Yeah.
For nearly 30 years. And then it was finally released. And when it was released, it was terrifying. And as you said, her identity was taken from her and replaced with this fractured identity of internalized self-hatred.
You're a Toppin, but not really a Toppin. You're like, you know, the bastard Toppin. That's kind of how she's looked at by her own family.
Her mind grows more warped and twisted as the years progress.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a victim who was ultimately consumed by madness and becomes this cruel and remorseless killer. Extremely cruel.
Yeah.
A psychopath.
For all we know, the foster mother was, I'm assuming she was incredibly cruel. In order to do that to a child, you have to be.
But
there's something fucking wrong with
you. I bet you no one who studied this case, who's written about this case, because I never get the sense, would say that the foster mother exhibits behaviors of a sociopath.
Yeah.
Or a sadist.
But she probably did. Because where did Jane learn it?
Well, I don't think she learned it from her. I think it was the abuse inflicted on her that caused it.
But that's a kind of teaching, isn't it?
No. It's what it's doing is...
Because you're teaching cruelty.
Rage.
Yeah.
You're teaching her hatred.
Yeah.
And I believe Jane is a monster born out of nature and nurture.
I do too.
Or there's another way of looking at this, which I call the American way.
She's evil and it doesn't matter.
She could be evil incarnate. That's the most comforting explanation. That's the one that allows all the good people of the world to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like nuance when it comes to defective human beings. And I think defective is a fair word to use here for Jane.
Right, because if we have to take responsibility as a society for all the wrongs that we're doing to people then and even now, I think it would be very hard for people to get to sleep at night.
We want to forget people like Jane Toppin ever existed. And there's even this argument that we should because they're bad people.
Well, you see it with how we treat the homeless people.
Yeah.
We see it with how you treat mentally ill people right now.
Society seeks to avoid blame in helping shape and mold predators. They don't want to think of themselves as responsible at all. We should never look into the abyss. Okay? True crime podcasts, don't look into the abyss. They're bad. Because we're exploiting victims by even talking about this. We're exploiting people from history. And yet, we're supposed to learn about the Holocaust, which is far worse than this case ever could be.
If you don't delve into...
Or slavery.
The inner workings of historical data, right? And what happens to people, why they become the way they do. You are doomed to repeat the same mistakes.
And we are.
we really are. I mean, you look at the foster system, it's fucking terrible. It's fucking terrible. It's not that much better. You know, we're still doing a lot of unimaginable things to kids.
What people believe and what they say are often two different things. I'll give you an example. So recently we had the conviction of the Parkland shooter, who is evil, vile. He is horrible.
Yeah.
He's also a child. And Florida is a tough state. They have very tough prisons.
Yeah.
Anybody who's studied the penal system in Florida knows this. And on Twitter and on social media, I'm always hearing liberals say, well, we shouldn't have the death penalty. It's bad. It's awful. It's the worst thing in the world. Because, you know, somebody black might die in the gas chamber. That's why they say this.
Right, even if they're guilty.
They don't really care about the cruelty. It's about virtue signaling.
Yeah.
So the Parkland shooter is convicted. He will die in prison, and he deserves it.
Yeah.
But that's not good enough. Because this issue is tied to gun control, and it's a right-left issue, and it's really about justice. So all the liberals suddenly are bloodthirsty and like, kill him! He should be tortured and murdered and all this stuff. And it's like, you guys don't believe your own shit.
I know, they're hypocrites.
You have to be morally consistent. I am for the death penalty in certain cases.
Yeah.
I have been consistent on this.
Same.
And I'm a liberal.
Yeah.
Okay?
I'm not for it all the time.
But not for mentally ill people being murdered. Not. I don't care. It's wrong.
Well, I kind of say some of these people should be just taken out of their...
Well, you can make that argument about people with depression. You could say, they're miserable.
Put them out of their misery.
They're miserable, so they should either kill themselves
No.
No, people make that argument.
That's a horrible argument. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying someone who has murdered hundreds of people and is insane...
Most people, Stephanie, have not murdered hundreds of people. That'd be like Hitler.
Yeah, but I'm talking about specific cases. That's where I go with the death penalty, specific cases.
I mean, if you're going to get numbers based, you could line up all the U.S. presidents and say they all deserve the death penalty because they have committed genocide. They all have. Every one of them has.
Well, yeah.
They ordered the button pushed.
I'm talking about individuals with individual crimes.
I'm talking about something far scarier, which is the system. Well, the system is death.
Yes, and your argument for keeping people locked up isn't really great because we can't even take care of the elderly.
So we should kill them too. Like,
no,
Kevorkian thought that.
We can't even take care of the elderly properly without abusing them, and they haven't done anything wrong. And
no,
you're expecting other human beings to then care for psychopaths, violent
psychopaths. Stephanie, that's a choice. We don't care about the elderly. We revere them, but we don't care about we don't want to take. We don't want
to. We hire McDonald's workers to care for the elderly. There's like one nurse to like every 50
that's
patients.
Capitalism.
And it's horrible.
That's capitalism.
Yeah. The American medical system is horrifying.
But getting back to Jane Toppin, we won't forgive or forget what she did. I don't. She's a monster. But most monsters start as victims.
Yes.
We are all the sum total of our experiences. Are we not? I would say we are. You
yes.
and I are formed by what we went through, you know, whatever, good and bad.
There's many studies on this, so yes.
And I believe that studying cases such as these helps prevent them from happening again. I think that's the whole point we're talking about. It's not that we are going to stop anything.
No, but I think if we had more people actually concerned about the welfare of children, the welfare of mentally ill people to prevent crimes, to prevent homelessness, to prevent a variety of things that happen to people from becoming ill. or becoming displaced. You could stop a lot of crime. You really could stop a lot of crime. So much crime comes out of poverty. And
yeah. Well, it comes out of other things, too.
Poverty, mental illness, trauma. There's a lot
but
of things.
But lives could be saved, is your
point. Yeah, that's my point. And we could... We're letting people die right now. You know, there. I don't even think there would be a drug problem the way it is if society was actually more equitable.
Okay. I want you to define something for me because I'm still confused. What is this thing you say... You're agreeing with me about evil incarnate's a bad idea, but what is an evil entity?
So, dark entities can be born, but most, or I don't even know if most, I would just say that a lot of dark entities, people can kind of live in this gray area. They haven't picked a side.
Right.
So I'm just talking about spiritually, soul-wise. This has nothing
just
to do...
Let it rip.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with science.
Let it rip like one of your farts.
Shut up.
I want to hear this.
And people can make choices and decisions that will lead them on a darker and darker and darker path until they are there.
Yeah.
Right? They can also do the other way. They can make good decisions and things that would help enlighten them and actually go towards the light. Those are also
so
choices.
So where does evil come from? Like this dark entity thing? Is it from space?
No, it's
because I keep thinking it's like from space.
No, it's cosmic. It's within us. It's within us.
Okay. So do you believe that Jane Toppin is evil? I'm not talking about her acts. I'm talking about herself.
Where she ends up, in my spiritual lexicon, if you will, she has become a dark entity. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I don't know if you would call that necessarily evil. It is certainly evil and malicious acts. So yes, I guess so. But
well, you remember when the director of the Joker movie was talking, and I was kind of confused because the movie to me doesn't show this. But he was saying that the Joker in the Joker movie, the Joaquin Phoenix movie, that by the end of the movie, he's just revealing his true self. And I didn't feel that way. I thought he started out as one person.
No, I thought it was more of a progression. Yeah, I thought those...
Something similar happens in Halloween Ends.
There's a progression, and maybe if something had intervened at some point, he may have not have ended up that way. Because I also think it's partly choice, but it's also partly circumstance as well. And
some people say we have no choice because ultimately we're on a path that's determined.
If you believe in free will, and I do.
Some don't.
I do. I also believe that you know, we do have a predetermined path.
Those are two diametrically opposed.
Yeah, but you can jump off that path if you want to and fuck everything up, or there's leeway
within
there.
So then it's not really predetermined.
Well, no, because you've chosen it already before you even decided to
incarnate.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
One day we're going to have to talk about reincarnation because I want to get to this. So, because I don't, for the record, I don't believe in reincarnation. Okay, so if Jane is evil, if she's a dark entity, as you say, let's just say she
has become a dark entity. Yes.
But
she didn't start that way.
Let's say she was bad from the beginning, born bad, born wrong. That's her true nature. Wouldn't curing her also take away who she is?
Yeah.
If someone is truly evil, with the capital letters, evil, then curing them is a grotesque violation of their individuality and their autonomy.
Now, are you talking about just... like therapy, mental, like therapeutics, are you saying if we had a mechanism to literally change someone's personality?
Or strip it from them.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. And I think even if we had the technology to do that, it would have to be up to the individual's choice. That is not up for us to decide.
It sort of feels like, based on what I researched at that hospital, that's kind of what happened mm-hmm. to Jane Toppin. Now, a lot of theories float around. Stephanie's saying lobotomy. Now, when I did the research on that, I found out that there were lobotomies performed as early as the 1880s. Yeah. So they could have done something, or they could have used drugs.
They could have done chemical lobotomies. So yeah. That was a thing. There was a lot of unethical experimentation. There still is unethical experimentation on human beings.
Identity was first stolen by her foster mother,
mm-hmm.
then by her doctors and nurses. And maybe that's what she deserves, but does it make her tormentors any less cruel or sadistic than she is?
No, because I think it makes us in some ways just as bad, because if we're no better than the people who commit the crimes, then how can we have any moral standing?
Well, that's the argument against the death penalty. You know, if you kill somebody, we'll kill you. It's like, well, then you're a murderer too.
Look, for certain cases, I think, you know, they should be people should be put in crow cages and starve slowly to death, depending on the crime.
Stephanie is sadistic.
I get medieval.
Now, I want to say something. When I was talking about the presidents, I wasn't advocating for violence against the presidents. I'm just saying, based on the numbers, they would fall under the category of genocidal maniacs.
Yeah, but that's all leaders of big nations because they commit wars. And
they're the scariest people. Yeah. They scare me far more than Ted Bundy ever could. I swear to God. I know viscerally Ted Bundy is more scary to people, but I'm not afraid of serial killers. They don't scare me. I just don't. I see them as pathetic. Okay. I feel like this is the Black Mirror conundrum because, yeah, if you take away somebody's identity, then you're kind of doing what they're trying to do, which is control people.
Yeah, and I don't think we have the right.
Violence is a fundamental part of who murderers are, just by definition. And so removing it from them denies them agency and identity. Evil is something that cannot or perhaps should not be separated from an individual if they are, as you say, an evil entity.
It's still in their soul, so how are you changing it?
They have to conquer their own demons and atone for what they have done on their own terms. Mm-hmm. They have to make a spiritual decision, as you would say, to do this. Drugging or lobotomizing them is Orwellian. It's like something out of 1984. It's Big Brother, which to me, that's the scariest kind of evil.
Well, there are people who have been in jail who I don't think were evil, but they were certainly gray. They've committed crimes, and they have atoned. They've done as much as they can to atone. And I think those people should be given a second chance, even if they've committed violent acts like, you know, armed robbery
the
or killed someone. I don't think locking people up forever and ever is helpful. If we can help people actually overcome what led them to that or for them to understand it. I'm not saying you just let them out.
No.
On their own reconnaissance. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if we had a system in place to actually help people overcome challenges, and a lot of it, so much of it is mental illness. So many crimes come out of undiagnosed mental illness.
Well, you know what I think? I think she was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm going to make the case for that in a minute. But the state using their means and authority to erase and devour the soul of a murderer or a robber or a sexual predator is actually kind of terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It is the point, I would say, that Kubrick is trying to make in A Clockwork Orange. And I know that's a book, but I haven't read the book. I've only seen the movie.
Yes, we're all illiterate here.
Oh, I've read plenty of, you know, the movie is great.
I'm being ironic, sarcastic.
Big Brother, an institutionalized authority, is the scariest form of evil to me.
He's talking about Orwell's 1984.
If you don't know what the fuck Big Brother is, it's not that fucking stupid reality show.
That's what they think it is.
Our audience is not dumb. You're calling our audience dumb.
No, I'm not saying our audience. I'm actually thinking of the dumbasses on Twitter.
I'm thinking of like girls on TikTok.
Yeah, them too.
Who are going to solve the crime.
And cry. They cry on command.
Cry and solve crimes.
Please stop crying on TikTok.
And dancing. No more dancing. Talk about evil.
Unless you're an actual dancer, get off.
America, and as we drift towards this election, I think we're realizing this more and more, is a Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
America seems to believe evil is an external and infectious force, a contagion or pathogen that can be passed from one person or generation to another. And usually it has something to do with satanic influence or demons.
I would say it's the religion.
I believe this is the view shared by most in Western societies, even by people who call themselves atheists, because most people are culturally Christian. They were raised Christian, mm-hmm. and that was their moral framework was formed through that.
Right.
Through that dogma. But I believe that evil is something much more ancient and biological. It was inside us when our ancestors first crawled out of the sea. I see it as rooted in the human condition. It comes from inside rather than outside. It is in you, Stephanie, mm-hmm. especially on Halloween. It is in me. It's in everybody listening to this episode, all three of them. Anyone can be evil under the right circumstances. What we call evil is really just the darkness within all of us. What Carl Jung called the shadow, mm-hmm. Jungian archetypes. The shadow is the thoughts we repress, our dark selves that we keep locked away in our brains.
Well, many people think he was psychic and also a medium.
No, I don't.
Food for thought.
But Jekyll and Hyde, that story.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that's about.
Yeah.
The duality of man. Civility versus barbarism.
Right.
Those are the two.
You strip off the thin veneer of society.
Duality.
And what are we underneath? Animals.
Evil is just a word. It's a label we use to condemn society's losers as inhuman. Because mm-hmm. if somebody is inhuman, then you can do anything to them. You can torture them, lock them away, throw them away, forget they ever existed.
Yeah.
It is how we try to distance ourselves from failed human beings. And I think Jane Taupin is a perfect example of a failed human being.
But society had a hand in shaping that failed human being.
Evil is a cop-out and an excuse. It lets society off the hook, which yes. is why we love that word. It's a four-letter word, and we really love it.
Mm-hmm. Especially the religious, because they really don't want to take responsibility for their bullshit.
It places all the blame on the individual.
Right.
Which is a very American mm-hmm. way of looking at society and the world.
We are rugged individualists.
Now, like I said before, I don't believe Jane Taupin was born evil. I believe she carried evil within us, as we all do. And society helped mold her into a sadistic and remorseless murderer with a poisoned mind. Make no mistake, Jane Taupin deserved to be punished for her heinous crimes. Justice must be served. And I believe it was, because she was locked away, guys.
Yeah.
But her story, the more I think about it, is more pathetic and sad than anything else. She's like a violent two-year-old with a morbid sexual deviancy.
Yeah.
And if a two-year-old was like 7 feet tall, they would kill their friends and take their toys. Because that's what they would do. If Jane Taupin is evil, so is her father. So is the orphanage she was surrendered to. Her foster sister's evil. The doctors and the asylum she was put in are evil. The doctors in the hospital that let her get away with murder are evil. Because I think they knew.
They knew. These other hospitals that have covered up.
All of these things.
Angels of mercy.
Evil. In one form or the other. It's a different kind of evil in each case, but mm-hmm. it's a form of evil. Apathy is evil. And none of them, unlike Jane Taupin, none of them were ever held accountable for what they did. And there's other cases we're going to get to, especially with doctors, that let people do things, they knew about it, and they were never held accountable. Like body snatching, for example.
Right.
But Jane was convicted. She was tried and convicted and locked away in a nut house. She got her comeuppance. And people act like she didn't. She did.
Oh, she did.
She did.
She was experimented on and poisoned.
Even if she wasn't, she was locked away for good.
Yeah.
And that's not what she wanted. She wanted to be in a regular prison.
They basically did an eye for an eye on her. And I think that was on purpose.
Her life was miserable and it ended in a miserable way,
mm-hmm.
I would argue. But look, she was a maniac. She was a psychotic lunatic. Much of her behavior defies reason. This is a woman who fondled her victims as they died and thought she could see their souls through their eyes.
Right.
She believed she could capture their souls or even death itself. This is not rational thinking. This is magical thinking. I know there's some people who be like, no, you're wrong.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of the magical thinking in the Victorian era as well, because there was
this, yeah, those people were crazy too.
The seen and unseen. No, but it was a trend. It was a trend
but
for many
years.
But
it's still magical thinking.
Yeah.
It's still irrational. It's not reasonable. And look, I'm open-minded, but this is crazy shit.
Of course it is.
She's insane. And I believe she ended up right where she belongs, in an insane asylum. In fucking Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
But the system did fail her. And they all share some of the blame for the cruelty and the lives lost due to her actions. It's not saying Jane doesn't. She got what was coming to her. But the system, it gets away.
Well, you know, again, this case reminds me of Albert Fish. And it reminds me of the Vampire of Sacramento, that kid. Can't think of his name.
Richard Trenton Chase.
Richard Trenton Chase. In the sense that...
Or Corey Cunningham.
My empathy is for them as the children they were who were damaged and abused and that could have been prevented. That's fucking sad. That is really fucking sad and heartbreaking because it didn't have to happen. Again, these things were preventable.
Well, what do you make ultimately? What is your main takeaway from Jane's story? Wrapping this up.
That we...
Could she have gone another way?
Yeah. Yeah, I think if she had actually been adopted into a loving home and not stripped of her name and not made to feel inferior about her birth, I think she's, even if she had still ended up as a nurse, she could have been a really brilliant nurse.
She was a good
nurse. Who saved lives rather than took them.
There's this weird anecdote where she talks about saving people from typhoid fever when she's asked about how many people she
killed. And she probably did.
You know, she did.
Yeah.
But she also killed a bunch of people.
Yeah, right.
So it's like, well, I killed people, but I saved a bunch of people, so that kind of makes it
even. She has a kind of, I don't know if it's a genius, but a brilliance. And medical chemistry.
She was gifted.
And she's gifted. And it's real. That's a shame. And it's in and of itself.
That's why we're talking about her.
We lose a person to darkness because they were mistreated and
by the system.
By the system and by, you know, people who should have known better, right? And had she been raised, honestly, it's like the other guy too, the pig farm killer.
Robert Picton.
Right, yeah.
Although he was an idiot, so.
He's an idiot, but yeah, I always feel like there's like this alternate timeline where like, if the trauma didn't happen, what would have, how they would have ended up, maybe not so bad, you know?
Stephanie, he was an idiot, and he was Canadian. God damn.
but he could have just been an average idiot farmer, and not an evil.
We will never recover from
idiot farmer.
The Canadians hating us for that.
I know, they all hate us now.
It's a joke, guys. It's a joke.
Guys, there's people in America who sound just like
we
that.
We have made fun of America in this
in Northern
podcast.
Midwest.
Oh, yeah. In this episode, we have made fun of America.
I make fun of my fellow Kansans all the time.
And they hate you every day.
Right, so you shouldn't feel bad.
They're going to poison you, like Jane.
I'm not picking on you specifically. I pick on everybody.
Jane was a Victorian monster born out of female repression and rage. And I believe, like Jack the Ripper, she was a personification of societal rot and decay. I think people like this only come from a sick society.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe that some people can only be rejected so many times.
Yeah.
There comes a point when they turn against the world and fall into the abyss. And this is how narcissism is formed, through trauma.
Well, some of these people end up committing suicide. Right?
Or becoming murderers.
Right. So it turns inward or it turns outward.
Well, she had a lot of self-loathing, even though she would deny it because she was ashamed, but she was ashamed of herself.
Oh, absolutely.
But rage, unconfronted rage, can transform a marginalized and dehumanized child into an angel of death. And that's my final thoughts.
And with that, we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.